Harvey mentioned that we take refuge within a recognition that we're not the only ones who experience suffering in life and who wish to reverse our habit patterns, our karma, what Buddhists call karma, the things that we do that perpetuate difficulties in our lives. And we've talked a lot about this, and it's always good to bring to mind a habit that, you know, you still haven't kicked, and that, you know it's not useful when you talk to people in a certain tone of voice, or, you know, say a certain kind of snarky thing, or make people wait for you. But we all do these things and more, and we find it difficult to reverse that. And we use our own, and then, then we have quarrels, and there's a harmony dissipates. And we know that there is discomfort, unsatisfactoriness in life. It's the first noble truth. And the key thing here in the Mahayana, the great vehicle, which is what we are mainly practicing, that we use our own pain, really two important things in our recognition of suffering. One is that we aspire to find freedom from it, as Harvey has said. Would that I could, not lose my temper 10 times a day. Maybe I could reduce it to 8. And actually, that would be a great progress, actually. That's actually significant, spiritual development. And the other thing that we do, very, very important, is that we use our own pain as an index to understand how other people feel. So when we sneeze with allergies, even if we never have before, this is what people go through when they talk about allergies. That's a lot of suffering. In other words, we use our our own pain to connect us both with refuge. If we can't acknowledge that there's some issues that trouble us, then refuge won't be that meaningful. Refuge means there's something we need refuge from. There used to be a saying, there are no atheists in foxholes. That's pretty interesting. And I think it's often said in a kind of cynical way, that you just believe in something when you're scared. But I think the other side of the looking glass is that, honestly, we're all scared. We just might not notice it until the situation goes way out of control. We all have things that we're worried about. We all have struggles. And so recognizing that, not keeping it in denial, but also not being overwhelmingly identified with it, this is what I want refuge from. Refuge isn't some ancient thing that now we're pulling through out of some kind of parroting, concern. But it's a human thing. As Harvey was saying, we all need refuge. A young child mother is the ultimate refuge. And since we've all been young children, we know what it is to feel arms around us when we need them. And we long for this all our lives. And the arms around us that we are seeking are very special kinds of qualities, as Harvey has also described, that we want. When we can achieve those qualities, we can start to be free too. So our recognition of suffering brings us to the possibility of refuge. It also brings us to the possibility of compassion, one of the three principal aspects of the path. And that compassion, if refuge is kind of vertical, compassion is horizontal, right? Compassion is for everyone, including ourselves. So the practice of refuge taps into really everything we know about life, everything that we know about why we would seek refuge. Well, because in fact, I can't do it alone. It does take a village. Everything takes a village. Putting on this retreat took a village, and the village miraculously arose. Not possible without a village. Life takes a village. Even the retreatant up in the mountains, there's a village taking care of him, he or her, usually, literally, bringing food, offering respect. So refuge is also about connection, profound connection. We are not alone. We can't survive alone. We also sing, for all of our admiration of John Wayne types, sometimes, you know, we also say, even in the West, no man is an island. That's pretty important. And really, any religious tradition, Christian faith is also about connection. Connection with something larger, higher, greater. So the urge to connect with refuge is, in, that's Buddhist language, for seeking, you know, solace, protection, comfort, which is universal. Every tradition offers some version of this. And so we are exploring specifically the way it opens up for us in Buddhism. And we speak particularly of, you know, what we call, translated, and we talked a lot about this in the retreat, what is faith but a permeability to blessings? You know, faith means, the way we understand it, the first type of, you know, just being delighted. When you're delighted in someone, I love this music, I love this poem, I love my mother, I love my grandmother, I love Guru Rinpoche, I love Jesus, that any of those is like, love means that, you know, your heart and your energy is open and you can receive. When somebody you love, when your mother teaches you how to grate potatoes, you know, it's completely different than, I don't know, watching it on TV or going to cooking school, right? Then it's just in your field, it's in your energy. And so when you feel this delight in a teacher with, oh, that means, oh, I like you. Yes, I, oh, you want to say something? I want to hear it. You want to teach me about something? I want to know, because you are somebody that I would like to be like. So refuge involves all of these. It's a very powerful, as Harvey said, body, speech, and mind. And the practice of Buddhism actually begins with refuge, begins with that sense of connection to those qualities. You know, Buddha was very loving. Guru Rinpoche was infinitely kind and really, really powerful. That sounds like a good combination. Yeah, I'd like some of that. You know, serve me some Guru Rinpoche energy. Serve me some abiding, peaceful wisdom of the Buddha. Yeah, dish that right up. I'm ready. That's refuge. You know, there's a certain kind of readiness and availability and an openness. We have to be open. We have to become teachable. A lot of instructions about how to listen to the teaching. Well, you have to be willing to listen and willing to say, you know, I've had this same old story about who I am and what I am and how I get myself into trouble. And you know what? I'm ready for a new story. I am. I'm ready to reflect in a different way on who I am and what I am and what's possible for me. Yes, I'm going to take refuge. And the message of Buddhism, you take refuge, a lot of positive things can unfold. A lot of positive things can unfold. And taking refuge also does mean some responsibility on our part. It means that we take a, when we formally take a vow of refuge, we promise not to harm. It's very important Buddhist principle, not to harm and to help if we can. So we take refuge. The reason I started saying that we take that this business of recognizing suffering, our own pain, you don't have to dramatize it more than it is. Everybody has enough, right? You know, families and friends, sick, crazy, out of work, stressed, too successful for their own good. Everybody has something out of balance, either in you or somebody you love for some period of time. How this can open us to refuge and open us to connection with the Sangha that helps us and interest us in the Dharma, the teaching. So Buddha, the teacher, Dharma, the teaching, and our community, Sangha, our friends, these are the three jewels in which we take refuge. And we also, because our suffering is connecting us not only to some idea of what we might do to escape it, but we recognize everybody wants out of this suffering. And so we dedicate our practice to others in our community. So we could pause for a moment, and if
there's questions.
Do you have comments or questions or just comments. How you related to anything that you heard tonight is also of interest?
There we go. The sense of being available and attuning with teachers is something that I did not appreciate very much until the retreat, actually. Mm. And I came up with note taking, because as you can see, I didn't bring my notebook. I usually have that. I always thought of it as, if I don't take notes, it means I'm not listening. It means I'm not paying attention, and I'm going to zone out. And there's a lot of holding with that. There's a lot of tenseness, but it means I'm not available. I'm not really available to at least, you know, kind of feel the groove and be there, at least be present to things.
With the note taking, is
while I'm note taking, yeah.
So note taking obstructs something.
It does. Yeah. It does. It's great because I pulled it out and I was pulling out little quotes that I'd write down and reflect, you know, after the retreat. So obviously there was some benefit from it, but even writing the note, there's tension and there was a lot of, you know, thinking, and there's a lot more separation. I wasn't as present. So I just liked that tonight where we talked about being present, you know, being attuned, really feeling with it. And I just want to share that.
Yeah. Actually, note-taking is a very interesting issue in terms of a spiritual training and teaching. And where I would leave it is, I think it's helpful for people to look at how it affects to note-take and to not note-take. So there could be a lot of stories told about in ancient India. They didn't take notes because there was really nothing you could write on that would survive. And so the tradition pretty much was to remember what was said by the teachers. And
they listened.
Listened very well. The tradition was to maintain the teachings by people being kind of human tape recorders. And so, like the Nepali canon, the scriptures, there's like the Digha Nikaya. It's a collection of the longer teachings of the Buddha. In English, it's about three volumes. It's about yay thick, three volumes. And so somebody could be what was called the Digha Banaka. Banaka means a reciter. And so their job description was, they learned it by heart, and that's what they did as a monastic. They recited the Digha Nikaya. And it's probably about 400 or 500 years before the teachings were written down on anything that could last, like maybe some walls somewhere. The great, was it Vonnegut, Fahrenheit 453, I think, where the people, they had book burners, so then people decided they would, you know, I am War and Peace Volume 1 and I'm War and Peace Volume 2. But they were actually doing that in the classic times. And in Tibet, the custom continued, so most students started very young when their minds are pretty impressionable. And the typical way that young monastics would learn is to learn all the books by heart. They wouldn't have a clue what the words meant. They couldn't. I mean, they don't have enough abstract thought. And sometimes even the prayers are like these amazing Dzogchen prayers. They have no idea. But they're just kind of human tape recorders. And then slowly, as their education developed, they would go back and figure out what the words meant.
And those, you know, tape recorders in one way, but not really tape recorders, because when you find out what something means that you've been reciting your whole life, it just really is bing, you know, because it's in your heart. It's their word for memorize is lola zin, hold in mind. It's So it's in mind. It's like sometimes you've known a song for many, many years, but, you know, there are always some words you don't really quite know, and then you find out, and somehow it's very fulfilling. I wanted to ask if you wanted to say anything about this recognition that you had in the retreat and what that's like for you and what exactly you feel is, you know, what did you see that was new that's impacting you now that made you know? You described it a little. I'm just giving you a little more space to see if you'd like to say more about it.
There's a lot more. There's a lot more flexibility. You know, I'm trying to think of where, how to put it. There's a lot more dance, playfulness, availability.
Wow, dance, playfulness, availability.
Yeah.
How do you recognize that?
I just I feel present more.
You feel more present.
Yeah. It's
what else?
Taking notes. There's a little bit of greediness to it. It's like, oh, I gotta remember that. I'm gonna remember that. I'm gonna write it down.
Right.
I gotta hold on to that. There's a lot of tightness with it, which I think is useful. And I think it's good to have be able to speak the lingo and participate in that way. But we're being asked to relax into something that's already there, and that's not how the process of taking notes and grabbing onto stuff and putting it, storing it away. It's kind of a different feel.
I have to say, I have notes that I find infinitely precious, of course, but it is a trade-off, you know. But maybe eventually they can come together, and you can be playful and available and resilient, flexible, even while you're taking notes, maybe. But first you have to identify this other thing, so that's great. Anything else? Anything online? No? Online people all tired?
You want to add something?
Yeah. During the retreat, I felt that, give me a second. During the retreat, I felt that, like, the teachings, they came in easier. I mean, like, I felt like I could really kind of digest them. And I realized that, being in a retreat setting, it was much easier.
Mm.
And I realized that there are, I guess, so many things on my table, and I had to push stuff off to allow for, be able to digest it.
Yeah.
And so I kind of reflected on that as I, you know, go back to work and all that. Do I really need to do all these things?
Oh, wow.
I have this huge to-do list, right? And so I looked at it and said, do I really need to do that? And it's kind of really, and even throughout my day, like I'm, you know, there are days I'm really booked. So I was like, can I put a space there between patient, you know, just kind of be with it? Otherwise, just kind of running, training. And then sometimes I find myself not being fresh. I feel like, oh yeah, I just kind of, this verbiage that comes out of my mouth with my patients and all that. And so I realized I need to be my patients.
Wow.
So, I mean, so I'm trying to really open space in my life so where I can be present and fresh and, you know, just kind of have space to take on the teachings and really reflect on it, so.
Hooray.
Thank you.
Hooray.
Thank you for bringing that
so
forward.
So you're describing really a process of moving from letting the kind of external just drive of it all, which most of us just let circumstances direct our lives, to moving towards, you know, I think I want to take a couple of breaths between clients, and I'm the boss of my life, and I could say I want to have 10 minutes just because I started 10 past 1 instead of 1. I mean, people can accommodate. And I notice a difference if I give myself 10 minutes or if I notice what a big to-do list, how it affects me versus being in a retreat where I don't have a big to-do list every day. And that's everything in a way that I was talking about in terms of causes and conditions and looking at our causes and conditions and just, it's not needing to be horrifically judgmental towards ourselves, but it's just like, okay, so I see these differences. Do I make some decisions? And this is what, when we're talking about mindfulness, discrimination, and conscientiousness, the mindfulness is we've got our mind on an object, so we are concentrated. And discrimination is, I realize something's coming up this way, something is coming up that way. And conscientiousness is, well, I want to emphasize sort of this spacious feeling that's coming up. I need to do something practically that will affect that. There really are some decisions I can make that will alter my experience. And so few people, you know, people say, you know, at the end of the day, I go to a bar. Why do you go to a bar? Well, I've always gone to a bar. And what do you do at the bar? Well, I drink with my buddies. And what happens when you go home? Well, I feel crappy. And I have a fight with my wife. Well, how come? Well, you know, I got drunk and I have a fight. Is that what you want to do? Well, I never really thought about that. Hello? But really, people don't consider their lives. All of us. You know, what do we watch? What do we eat? What do we smoke? What do we drink? What does the city we live in look like? What does the country we go to look like? Everything does affect us, and we can make many, many small decisions. I think it was somewhere very, very recently, I think it was in the retreat, Anne was talking about karma, and that, you know, small decisions can have huge effects. You put 10 minutes between three clients a day, you might feel very, very different. Just 10 minutes.
That's a huge lesson. Thank
you. Huge. So look at that. It's two pieces. It's those 10 minutes, and it's the fact that you decided to take 10 minutes, both of those. And that you're not just, oh, my clients, and it's sort of like this tsunami of clients. It's wonderful to hear. And it's really important, and we really want to celebrate that and acknowledge that that's a big change for you. It's very, very useful.
Beautiful. Yeah. I also want to acknowledge that part of what gives you the oomph to do that now is a very important discrimination that's implicit in what you said, which namely that very clear realization of what a little more space feels like and how important that is. So that discrimination is really kind of fulcrum or jumping off point for your determination, what I'm hearing, your determination to. That's
definitely.
Just so wonderful.
Huge shift.
What?
It's a huge shift.
It's a huge shift.
Yay!
It's another new story, right?
Yeah.
A new story about what Kwong is and what Kwong does with his life and how he does it.
So one of the things that having a retreat can do is it kind of creates a different and new bottom. Whatever our bottom was, we see something, we experience something, and we integrate it slightly differently into our lives. It's wonderful, and it's real. And for you, that's a very, very real takeaway. It's terrific.
Thank you.
And you've been moving toward it for a long time. Yes, it's fruitional.
Yeah. I've heard so many times, and finally it's I'm getting it. Yeah,
that's one, exactly. And that's what it takes for all of us. We all hear many things many, many times. How often do we say, as people said during the retreat, I've heard this so many times, and, you know, it has to come together. And it doesn't. And also having heard it many times is part of what finally allows that to occur, that in your own listening.
Thank you.
Refuge, you know.
Thank you.
A permeability to refuge is really part of it.
If you enjoyed this teaching, please visit our website, donmountain.org, to subscribe to this course and find other great Dharma offerings. May all beings always have happiness and its causes. May all beings always be free of pain and its causes.